For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So, good morning, Bodhisattvas.
Good morning.
I am Hogetsu, and I'm having the pleasure to allow our Dharma brother to introduce himself, Siddhesh Mukherjee. So tell us what you'd like us to know about yourself.
Good morning again. why don't we begin with names? It's just some of you are here for the first time, perhaps, and also I haven't been here regularly for the past few months, unfortunately, so I might not know some of you. My name's Siddhesh, or Sid for short.
Hogetsu.
Here.
Alec.
Eric.
So, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you in this way. And I'll begin with a story, a Zen story, and I'll read it once, and then I'll provide some background, and I'll read it a second time. When Master Matsu Daoyi returned to his hometown for a short visit, he was warmly welcomed by his countrymen. But an old woman, who used to be his next-door neighbor, said, "I thought that all the commotion was caused by the visit of some extraordinary person. In fact, it's just the little boy who's the garbage collector's son." On hearing this, Matsu improvised the following poem. "I advise you not to return to your native place, for no one can be a sage in his own home. This old woman by the side of the brook still calls me the garbage man's son." And so, some background into the story. Matsu Daoyi is a 8th century Chinese master who's renowned in his own time. So this is someone who is considered brilliant, vivacious, larger than life, this renowned Zen master who attracted students from across China. And he goes to visit his hometown. So he's already very well known, and there's a lot of hubbub, there's a lot of commotion when he comes. People are excited that this renowned Zen master has come to visit. And there's one old woman who sees him. And this old woman knew him as a child. So she sees him not as Matsu Daoyi, great Zen master. She sees him as the kid who's the garbage collector's son. And so she says this. And Matsu, he doesn't react with anger or with defensiveness, or he doesn't try to put people in their place. He improvises a poem. A humorous poem, a light-hearted poem, a large-hearted poem. And so I'll read the story again. When Master Matsu Daoyi returned to his hometown for a short visit, he was warmly welcomed by his countrymen. But an old woman who used to be his next-door neighbor said, "I thought that all the commotion was caused by the visit of some extraordinary person. In fact, it's just a little boy who was the garbage collector's son." On hearing this, Matsu improvised the following poem. "I advise you not to return to your native place, for no one can be a sage in your own home. This old woman by the side of the brook still calls me the garbage man's son." So I really enjoy this story, and I've encountered it in a few places, a few books, and I read it from this very important book called The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. And the reason that I appreciate the story in this book is because it's accompanied by a commentary by Edo Francis Carney, who is a Zen teacher and the abbess of a temple in Japan. And so, in this commentary, which is, I think, very helpful and enjoyable, Edo Francis Carney often uses the word authenticity. She's talking about this great Zen master and his authenticity. He's not encumbered by arrogance. He's okay being the garbage collector's son. So this is a tale of modesty, of humility. And I think when I read this story, the word that comes up for me, the word that this story evokes, is ordinariness. I'm impressed. I admire how comfortable Matsu is with his own ordinariness. He doesn't have to be Matsu. The Zen master who has to be a Zen master isn't much of a Zen master. He's content being the garbage collector's son. He's comfortable with that. And so I'd like to spend a few minutes just sharing some thoughts about ordinariness and how I see its value. And let me begin by clarifying. The ordinariness, the way I'm saying this, is not in contrast with uniqueness. I think each of us is thoroughly unique. We each have our causes and conditions that have created the person we are today, and there's never been a person like you, and there never will be a person like you. This is simply a fact. And so we are each thoroughly unique, and to my mind, this doesn't conflict with our ordinariness. I use ordinariness in contrast with specialness. To my mind, specialness is thinking that any of us could somehow have more value than anyone else in the room. That any of us could be elevated in some way over any other person. That maybe in some subtle way, one of us has something more valuable to offer than something else. So this is specialness. And to my mind, ordinariness is an antidote to the delusion of specialness. And so let me share a few words, please, a few thoughts about ordinariness and its value in our practice of sitting meditation, zazen, our practice of relationship with each other, community, sangha, it's called in Buddhism, and our practice of cultivating relationship with ourself. So ordinariness. In my experience, sitting zazen is immersion in my own ordinariness. I sit and this experience unfolds. And sometimes this experience unfolds as a joy, sometimes as solidity, sometimes as a feeling of love, a feeling of warmth. And this experience simply unfolds when we sit. And the more familiar I am with this experience over here, the experience called Siddhesh, the more able I am to celebrate your experience when it unfolds as joy, when it unfolds as solidity, when it unfolds as love and warmth. Because this is all pretty ordinary. This is all our inheritance as humans. As humans, we are of the nature to unfold as joy, as solidity, as love. So the better I know, the better I'm familiar with my joy and my my love, the more I can laugh when Bo says something funny. See, that was funny itself. He can't help it. He can't turn it off. The more I can laugh, the more I can celebrate Bo. The more I'm familiar with my own joy, the more I can celebrate when Douglas says he's retiring and has time to take language courses for the UFC. It's wonderful to be able to celebrate this. And it's all quite ordinary. This is very ordinary. This is my experience. This is your experience. And sometimes this experience that, you know, we can call Siddhesh, unfolds as exhaustion, as anger, as a despair. And the more familiar I am with my own exhaustion, anger, and despair, then when your experience unfolds as anger, exhaustion, and despair, the more able I am to say yes to you. In your anger, in your exhaustion, in your despair, it is still good that you are here. It's still good that you exist. Right now, it's good that you exist. This is something my own Zen teacher is fond of saying. It's good that you exist. He asks the question, what do we mean when we use the word love? And his response is, it's good that you exist. And so this is something I've taken on. I'm very fond of this. And so I guess we could say that sitting in our own ordinariness, our own inheritance of joy and love and exhaustion and despair are human inheritance, perhaps it opens up a more authentic compassion. Perhaps sitting in our own tendencies opens up a more authentic compassion. I sit in Zazen and I'm often, I often notice that I'm of the nature to feel worn out, to get impatient, and to treat you not as well as I ought to. I'm of this nature. Sometimes I get worn out and I don't treat you as well as you deserve. And this is quite ordinary. Perhaps you too are of the nature to feel worn out, impatient, and not treat me as well as I deserve. Perhaps you too are of this nature. And this is quite ordinary. We can work on this. We can work on this. But even now, it's good that we're here. It's good that you are you. It's ordinary. It's good that you're here. I sit in Zazen and I see that I'm of the nature to sometimes let my ego get in the way and say things that I wish I hadn't said and then apologize to you and hope that you will forgive me. Maybe you are also of this nature. Maybe this sounds familiar to you. And this is quite ordinary. And so when I rub you the wrong way, when you rub me the wrong way, when we step on each other's toes, we can work on this. And even now, it's good that you're here. It's good that you exist. This is all ordinary. It's okay. Sometimes, I sit in Zazen and it's very clear to me that I'm of the nature to feel lost. I'm of the nature to wonder what I'm doing with my life. I'm of the nature to wake up in a dark room at night and look onto something strange and unfamiliar and wonder where I really am. Maybe this is familiar to you. This is quite ordinary. And so we come in the next day and we sit Zazen and then we sip tea together and I ask you, how are you? And you say, I'm fine. And perhaps you are fine. Perhaps things are going well and I'd like to celebrate that with you. But perhaps I'm fine is something you say because you wouldn't even know how to start. Because you wouldn't even know where to begin saying something to utter the reality of the situation. And so, this is how I am and this is how you are. And I can say it's good that we're here. It's good that we're here together. And whatever it means when you say I'm fine, I'm glad that you exist. So we can think of this ordinariness as perhaps a door to a more authentic compassion. It's lovely to be ordinary. It's lovely to appreciate my ordinariness. And we can think of ordinariness in different ways as well in terms of this practice. I'll read a couple excerpts. So the first is by Linshi, the 9th century great master, Rinzai in Japanese. The master addressed the assembly saying, "Followers of the way, as to the practice, no effort is necessary. You only have to be ordinary with nothing to do. Defecating, urinating, wearing clothes, eating food, and lying down when tired. Fools laugh at me, but the wise understand." Let me read it once more. The master Rinzai addressed the assembly saying, "Followers of the way, as to the practice, no effort is necessary. You only have to be ordinary with nothing to do. Defecating, urinating, wearing clothes, eating food, and lying down when tired. Fools laugh at me, but the wise understand." One more quote. This one is in the 20th century, Kodo Sawaki Roshi. Buddha Dharma, and let me provide context. Buddha Dharma we can think of as the practice of Buddhism, the practice of, quote-unquote, the way, what we do here, what we take outside when we leave here, hopefully, Buddha Dharma. So, Kodo Sawaki says, "Buddha Dharma simply guides us to the place where there's nothing special. Many people understand faith as a kind of intoxicated ecstasy. There are illusions or exhilarations that seem holy. True faith appears when we sober up." I'll read it once more. Koto Sobaki Roshi, 20th century. Buddha Dharma simply guides us to the place where there is nothing special. Many people understand faith as a kind of intoxicated ecstasy. There are illusions or exhilarations that seem holy. True faith appears when we sober up. I think this is a very profound way to practice. How do I sit zazen while still being ordinary? I think it's wonderful to sit with concentration, with deliberation, to sit in an upright, relaxed position, chin slightly tucked, eyes gazing softly at a 45-degree angle in front of us. It's wonderful. We need concentration, we need deliberation. And every now and then, if we catch ourselves maybe trying a little too hard, so we're sitting so upright that we look like some sort of rocket ship that could lift off at any time, perhaps we could just kind of remind ourselves, it's okay. It's okay, it's good to be ordinary. Rinzai said it, it's okay, it's okay. I can relax a little, it's okay. It's good to be ordinary. It's good to be concentrated and deliberate when we're doing walking meditation, to be aware of how our body is moving, to embody our experience. At the same time, if we catch ourselves overdoing it every now and then, if we notice that perhaps we're walking like the Pink Panther, or you know, some sort of Zen robot, Taigen, or Taigen is fond of saying Zen zombie, and I'm fond of that too. If we notice that we're doing it kind of like a Zen zombie, perhaps we can just catch ourselves and say, it's okay, it's okay. It's good to be ordinary. And finally, when we share with each other, it's wonderful to speak, you know, in a heartfelt way, to be vulnerable with each other, to actually ask the questions that are a major part of our lives. This is wonderful. And every now and then, if we catch ourselves wanting to say something really clever, something really, you know, insightful, just to give everyone a glimpse into the bottomless well that is our profundity, maybe we can just catch ourselves and say, it's okay, it's better to be ordinary. And I poke fun right now, and let me just add, this is largely poking fun at myself. I don't know how many times I've opened my mouth hoping something clever or profound would come out. And joke's on me. I think it's better to be ordinary. So how do we do all of this while still being ordinary? I think this is a profound way to practice. And I think we owe this to each other. So poking fun aside, making jokes aside, we talk about taking refuge in Sangha. What does that mean, taking refuge in community? What does it mean to be here for each other? If I'm preoccupied with my specialness, with seeming in a certain way, can I really be here for you? Am I really hearing you? If I'm thinking about how I seem in the moment, am I really seeing you? If I'm preoccupied with my agenda, taking refuge in the Sangha, to my mind, obligates us to drop it. To drop the project of specialness, to be ordinary for each other, to hear each other and see each other and drop the project of specialness. And so I think it's paramount to take refuge in each other's ordinariness, in our own ordinariness, to be here for each other in the most simple way, the most heartfelt way. And beyond the relational aspect, this ordinariness is important in the existential dimension of this practice. And now let me say, what follows, if this sounds confusing or cryptic, please just put it aside. I'm attempting to express something that's difficult for me to express, and so please just toss it out if it sounds confusing or cryptic. Forgive me. Let me apologize in advance if that's what it comes out as. The existential dimension of this practice, it's good to wonder, what are we doing when we sit? We sit here for 35 minutes. What's it about? As many of us know, the 13th century Zen master Dogen said, to study the way is to study the self. To study the way is to study the self. And when we sit in this inquiry, this existential inquiry, who am I? Or better yet, what am I? We sit in this existential inquiry. What is this that thus sits? And to my mind, we thwart ourselves. We thwart our own inquiry if we sit with some idea of specialness or some agenda. Why is that? I'm sitting to become enlightened, or I'm sitting because I want to become a more compassionate person, or I'm sitting because I want to be patient. All of this is already founded on a lot of assumptions. Our study of ourselves is already thwarted by our assumptions of who I think I am, what I think I am, what I think enlightenment is, what I think patience is, what I think compassion is. If I want to study the self, I think I ought to drop it. I ought to put all that stuff aside, the baggage of my own assumptions, and just be profoundly ordinary. Ordinary in the most profound sense. What am I before my thoughts about me? What are you before your thoughts about yourself? Profound ordinariness. And in this place of what am I before my thoughts about me, there's no place for specialness, there's no place for ordinariness. There's no place for anything, really. What am I before my thoughts about myself? There's no place for the garbage collector's son. There's no place for Matsu. There's no place for Siddhesh. And ironically, in this place where there's no place for any of that, that's exactly when Matsu and Siddhesh see eye to eye. And so that's enough about that. And again, forgive me if that didn't make any sense. Please just toss it out if it came across as confusing. It's not very important, so please just leave it aside. Let me just conclude with the story, and I love this story. It's about the 20th century Zen master Soen Nakagawa, who is very influential in American Zen, in the blossoming of American Zen. And in this story, Soen Nakagawa is young, and his teacher is the other character, Genpo Yamamoto Roshi. And so Genpo is the mature Zen master, the wise Zen master. And in this story, you know, Soen Nakagawa is, you know, with all due respect, he's kind of the young fool in the story. And so it's quite enjoyable. One day, Genpo Roshi asked monk Soen to accompany him to the temple where he had been ordained. On this occasion, the war had just ended and traveling by train was nearly impossible. Overwhelming crowds would wait for days for trains, which ran infrequently and unpredictably. When a train did arrive, there would be a mad rush not only for seats, but for standing room or a place to hold in a doorway. Genpo Roshi and monk Soen found a spot in an aisle. Genpo Roshi sat on the floor, squeezing his body into an uncomfortably small spot. Monk Soen, however, sat in full lotus on the floor. Many people admired his zazen concentration. On the way back, there were the same overcrowded conditions. Upon returning to their home temple, Genpo Roshi called Soen into his room and scolded him in a thundering voice. "What's the matter with you? Zazen is not a performance. Under such circumstances as we had, you must think of others and make yourself as small as you can. That is zazen. Get out of here." Monk Soen, who had been so admired in the train, left Genpo Roshi's room humiliated and angry. He went to a pond and jumped into the water. Mulling over his teacher's words, he understood what Genpo meant, and he returned and apologized. Isn't this great? He makes a fool of himself, then he pitches a fit, and then he goes and apologizes. What could be more beautifully ordinary? So, thanks for listening. At this time, please let us share any thoughts, reflections, and unless you have something that's specifically for me, I'm just going to be quiet so that we can have a collective conversation. So, thanks.
Thank you for that talk. That was very and I was just thinking, what it stirs up for me is that sometimes, even here, coming and doing this practice, I have a sense of sometimes I don't do it that much, so I'm not really a practitioner. But then other people do it better, or you know, this is something special to strive for, or those thoughts, you know, are in my head sometimes. And right, it's just me who we are and doing what we do and practicing in this way there. I think so in this idea of we're always trying to get to something, you know, like I have a to-do list and it's like if I get all that done, I'll be accomplished or I'll be ahead of things or I will be better. And it's like it's in the doing. It's like that's not going to stop. That's going to go on the rest of my life. And, but it's hard to get off of that way of thinking.
Helpful in eliminating insights from your talk, I feel, Sadash. I was thinking about this knowing of someone when they're a baby, and you know what their poop smells like. that there's, you know, nothing is hidden. And this, I also think there's something about like who is sitting, you know, zazen in this train car, not thinking he's probably also taking up space for all these people. You know, I mean, there's this kind of situation that happens all the time, but there's something about like there's also space for that, like striving for specialness. You know, that like I don't want to put somebody down because they're doing that. And I think a good teacher, you know, in some ways his teacher was like, dude, wake up, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's other ways to help each other wake up and give each other lots of space. And I often think of that too, that there's places for all of, the inclusivity is boundless. Mm-hmm. And I thought this really speaks nicely to that. So I really appreciate that and hope I can carry out that project for the rest of my life.
Thank you for saying that. Something I should add to my appreciation for the Sangha, and I think patience is a word that comes to mind. So many people have been patient with me through my own growing pains and my own like childishness, and continue to be patient with me. And this patience allows me to, you know, gradually see more and more into what's going on, and maybe do something a bit different. Thank you for adding that. Should we wrap up? Anyone have anything? Well, thanks for listening.
Thank you. I think now maybe we'll have a few announcements, and then we'll end with our Bodhisattva vows.